L'une de mes toutes premières interviews, bien avant la création de Volant, date de 2011. J'étais à San Francisco et j'avais eu la chance de croiser la route d'un des fondateurs de Airbnb. Si vous cherchez sur un moteur de recherche, vous verrez que je n'étais pas très doué à l'époque d'ailleurs. Mais j'étais impressionné et ravi car j'ai toujours trouvé la capacité de Airbnb à créer une communauté de partage vraiment incroyable. Et donc depuis, l'appartement dont je suis propriétaire a toujours été sur Airbnb pour les moments où je suis en vacances ou simplement absent, car cela me permet d'arrondir les fins de mois. Avec ce supplément de revenus, je peux partir en voyage au Japon en 2016 par exemple, sans doute l'un de mes plus beaux voyages. Donc si vous avez une chambre de libre ou si vous partez en week-end, vous avez sans doute vous aussi un Airbnb. Pour découvrir combien pourrait vous rapporter votre logement, rendez-vous sur airbnb.fr/hôte. C'est airbnb.fr/hôte. H-O-T-E. Allez, place à l'épisode maintenant.
For those who have read my book, you know that I talk a lot about my own contradictions. Also because I believe that contradictions are at the core of what makes us humans. And so they are everywhere. And today I'm delighted to receive Nathan Dufour, who is a poet, who is a philosopher, very much focused on ecology. And he's a very interesting character because he's sharing his knowledge through small videos, but also through rap music. And together, we are discussing our own contradictions. We are discussing about contradictions in a world that is so binary, especially on social media, when the society we're living in is so complex. And so we talk a lot about this position that I love, which is high confidence gray, when a lot of people are very much into high confidence black or high confidence white or low confidence white or low confidence black. But in a complex world, the reality is much more gray. And you'll see this conversation is very deep and yet super entertaining, I hope. I hope you'll enjoy it. I'll let you listen to it. Allez, Volant, c'est parti. So hi, everyone. Hi, Nathan.
Hi.
How are you doing?
I'm doing well.
Good. We're going to talk about paradox.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And contradictions.
Okay.
Actually, I wrote a book on ecology called Unsustainable Paradise, where I'm wondering how can you change without sacrificing anything? And where I talk a lot about my paradox when it comes to ecology, because I feel like, yes, I know a lot of stuff about ecology, and yet I'm not really ready to sacrifice anything. And I was wondering how or why are you interested into ecology, and why and how are you interested into paradox? And did you connect both also?
Yeah. The last sentence that you just said, I'm trying to recall how you said it, that you feel like you're interested in talking about ecology and you wrote a whole book about it, but you also are recognizing in yourself that you're not prepared to actually accept it into your behavior, into your practice.
I do, but you know what I do? And there was a book about it, and I thought it was so relevant because so precise. Like, I do sacrifice things that don't really matter. So I eat less meat because it's also better for my health.
Yeah.
I will make sure that my beans are okay. I will use less plastic.
Yeah.
But those things don't really matter. I mean,
well, they
eventually
do. We can talk about the way in which they do, but I think it does hit upon an important insight that it's really important as a starting place to examine the contradictions in one's own desire structure, that we are so enculturated not to want an ecological world and an ecological consciousness that some of our deepest desires and most immediate and most vivid satisfactions run precisely counter to that actualization. There was one time the other day that this really struck me because I had just started dating Fiona, who's now my girlfriend, and it was when our relationship was first starting to blossom, and we had eaten some Japanese food, and we were eating some gummies, some sour gummies in a little plastic package, and we were watching a movie on Netflix, and I was looking around my room at all of the cables and cords and all of the energy systems that were culminating in this moment of total relaxation and leisure and cuddling with this beautiful woman and watching this movie and eating these gummies in this plastic wrapper, and I was like, I assent. I assent to it all. bring it on. I was like, this is worth the destruction of the globe and every species that's not human upon it. And all I want is this, because my pleasure is so distinct that I truly feel in this moment that it's worth it. And I was aghast, because this is me on a Friday night chilling out, and my job is eco-influencer guy who talks about these ideas and talks about cultivating ecological consciousness. And I was a little disturbed by it. But then it struck me as something that I really need to look at, because I don't see it acknowledged in these spaces. I don't see people going, yeah, I really do want to watch it all burn, because part of our human nature does. I even think that the part of us that does want to do that is the same part of us that's capable of the kinds of radical transformative acts in our action that can actually bring about the change. The same part of us that has the fire that's willing to destroy because we get such pleasure from that subjugation that we wreak with that behavior can be transmuted as an energy flow into saving the day.
That's also a very interesting topic. We are both Luke Skywalker and Dark Vader.
Yes, good way to put it. Yeah,
I mean, we have both.
Yeah, we got both.
And we like to believe that we are Luke Skywalker.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of people are not even aware of the Dark Vader somehow, you know, the dark side of things. But what you're saying is that the dark side might be actually the answer to go for the light.
We at least have to make an account of the dark side. We don't get very far if we are not examining our repressed desires or the desire structures that have led us to the behavior that we're currently engaged in. If we suddenly decide that we've overhauled our identity and we've said, okay, now I'm an eco-warrior and I'm just going to completely change my behavior profile, we're either going to fail to do that, or we're going to play act like we're doing that, or we're going to do so in a very incomplete and maybe self-contradictory way, in a way that we haven't examined, unless we do the work of going, wow, I don't actually want an ecological world. Sometimes this is implicit even in people's behavior, because I think there is a dichotomy in ecological thinking between technological solutions that try to preserve the continued practice of the desire structure that the modern Western civilized world has. And then there are other forms of solution that reject all of those technological apparatus that say, no, we can't really put a technological band-aid on a technological problem again and again and again. And we actually need to want different things. Mm-hmm. And so changing what you want is a totally different proposition. And in either case, though, I think you have to really examine what you actually want, and not just examine what you actually want, but why you want it.
And that's actually a very good point, because eventually, when you really deep dive into those questions, I think you realize that you don't really know why you want things. I guess you want things because society, because also sometimes buying is... Lately, with a friend of mine working at a very high position at Google, and she was telling me, well, after all the studies, we found out that people buy for two reasons mainly. One is, I really need the product. The other one is, I'm depressed.
Yeah. Yeah, it feels good. It feels good. There's a moment in Braiding Sweetgrass, which is this book by Robin Wall Kimmerer. It's a book about synthesizing indigenous American ecological perspectives with Western scientific ecological perspectives.
Oh, wow.
And finding a harmony between the two and acknowledging both as complementary worldviews, because she comes from both worlds.
Wow.
And the part that came to my mind just now is one where she's in a store and she's debating whether to buy some disposable plastic object, like some markers or something like that. Something that you kind of need and it has a use value. And she's reflecting on how precisely this is the moment where my behavior is the terminus point of my value system. Will I buy these markers or not? And she has this sort of discussion with herself. It's like there's this dialectical struggle going on between the two different sides of her consciousness, the consumeristic side and the side that rejects that and wants to have a more sacred relationship with matter and doesn't want to have anything to do with some plastic fucking markers. She has that conversation with herself, and then she ends up buying them. I don't know what to do with that, but she does.
No, but it's actually, you know, there is also this debate where... can you fly if you are, even if it is to, you know, say good things about the planet on the other side of the planet.
Yeah.
And flying is probably the worst thing you can do ecologically. So
I mean, it's always going to be the case that the individual action will add only incrementally to the problem. But it does add to the problem. It adds to the problem materially because you are participating in a market that adds more of that pollution, whatever that happens to be, whether it's, you know, fossil fuels used to fly the jet or what have you. And it adds in the sense of giving more strength to that market that perpetuates that process. So it always does add up. And what was it? There was something in your question that made me...
The question was, there's also people that, you know, is it okay to fly?
Ah, okay. Yeah. So yeah, this question. There is currently a skepticism about the logic of personal responsibility, which is a valid skepticism because it is true that in America, at least, corporations historically and presently try to push the narrative of personal responsibility in order to abnegate their own responsibility. However, this is why their strategy is so ingenious, because the thing that they're using to co-opt the discussion is true. Because we do have personal responsibility. Just because it's wrong that they are not taking responsibility and foisting the responsibility on you, even though it's proportionally less your responsibility, morally speaking, doesn't mean that it isn't your responsibility, because it in fact is. And this is where I think we need to really re-examine desire structures and value systems. We give a lot of shit to Western value systems as being inherently the cause of the problem, like, oh, Western philosophy with its division of mind and matter, or Christianity with its division of the material world and the realm beyond. But I think the problem is not that we have those systems. The problem is that we are not actually looking at them in a serious way. Almost all Western philosophers, if you applied their ethical system, would ask you to be extremely radical. If you really went back to Plato and Socrates, or if you go to Christianity, it asks a very radical set of behavioral practices from you. There's the parable of the rich young man who comes to Jesus and he's like, hey, I follow all of the law, all of the Torah, all of the commandments. I'm your biggest fan. I think you are the Messiah. I think you're great. What else should I do, Jesus? And Jesus is like, sweet, no problem. Just go ahead and sell all of your possessions and follow me. And the rich young man is like, that I cannot do. I can follow the law. I can be the biggest fan. I can believe that you're the Messiah, but I can't just totally transform my entire life. And that's the radical thing that Christianity asks you to do. And early Christianity had that radical behavioral aspect in the Roman Empire. They formed little communes. They withdrew from society. They rejected the notion of private property as a coherent concept. So whether rich or poor, you are now living in this totally different reality. That's what ecological consciousness asks you to do in a certain respect, if ecological consciousness involves a sacred attitude toward matter. And so we have to ask ourselves, and even draw on, I think, our religious traditions, especially as people who are of European extraction, like myself. You know, I don't need even to look outside my own traditional, familial, ancestral traditions to find the same core radicality that is now being discovered, or quote unquote discovered, in indigenous thought, indigenous American thought, for instance. Both of them have strength to offer, but the point is, you can't just be interested in it as a genre of critique. You have to actually do it. And actually doing it begins, I think, with going like, wow, I am an addict. My entire desire structure is to want gummies and movies all the time. And if you admit that, then you can at least go like, all right, word. Let me experiment with not doing that, you know?
Yeah.
I think.
But do you think we can sell... I don't know about selling that idea, but I'm struggling myself. I'm not describing myself as an activist because basically I am not. I mean, I flew here, so I am definitely not an activist. I describe myself as someone who is engaged in the issue. And I make the difference because for me, when you're an activist, you're usually an activist against.
Right.
When you are engaged for something. That's the way I see it. I'm not saying it's true. It's probably a better way to justify myself.
Yeah.
But I would love to have your point of view, also including your contradictions.
Yeah. I want to pause, I guess, for a second on that word activist, because I've been thinking about it a lot. There, I can't think of a word that is more indirect than activist, because active is an adjective, and then it's to believe in being active. Just etymologically, it bespeaks some of the problems with that identity, because it's become an identity. And there's people who are turned off by the identity. There's people who go like, oh, activist, because they see that quite often it's people playing a game of building their identity around resistance to a certain thing. And then most of that resistance takes the form in some contexts of performative rejection of somebody else's ideas, which itself is just an ideological activity. It's not a direct material action. So speaking in the context of ecology, the New York Times, in its little climate roundup that it does, the week after Climate Week, published a summary that said, Climate Week was like Burning Man for climate nerds. Are you familiar with Burning Man?
I've been there.
Okay, yeah. You've been. So I thought that was the most ridiculously, perhaps accidentally insightful thing. It was a party. It was a party of come perform the identity of giving a shit. Come to these events where you get to hear music or go rah, rah, rah and rally the troops and drink from some plastic water bottles provided by the event. I performed at some events like this.
Oh, wow.
Which has nothing to do with the thing itself. So in the same way that Burning Man recently has been getting criticism for being this sort of endlessly cyclical simulation of what an ideal world can be instead of actually building the ideal world, the same thing happens in the climate space. And when we decide to be like, I'm an activist, this is my profession. You know what that profession often involves? Making tons of Instagram posts. And in so doing, often participating in the same processes of extraction and sort of self-neutralization that somebody who's in a totally different space finds himself in. That's not to say that activism is bad. This is an instance of holding contradictions like we were talking about. We can be critical of the very identity role of activist and still recover the secret essence of it, which is action. And there's many people who are identified as activists or are in fact self-identifying as activists who are doing great work, but action is the point. And I think sometimes activism effaces action, because it makes it so I have to constantly iterate this idea. It operates in an ideological space rather than a material space. The whole ecological problem is one of having forgotten about matter. Who's a better agent of change in the world? The radical leftist climate change activist who's spreading the word about the existence of climate change in extremely creative content, that's me, by the way, or the far right Trump-supporting permaculturalist who has transformed their home into something that's off the energy grid because they don't trust the government for different reasons than the reasons I don't trust the government, and has changed their whole world and their whole ecosystem as a result of it. Who is doing more material work? The person who is spreading the word and using the iPhone, or the person who has changed the energy structure of their actual habitat? Maybe both are. I'm not trying to say aren't important, but I think that we really get lost in the weeds and fail to recognize our allies precisely because we're so blinded by our identity masks. A persona is literally a mask, and it's like we're all wearing the mask in such a way that it's mashed on our face and we can't even see through the eye holes.
I very much like this idea. I think you're totally right. It is a performance of identity somehow. Even though people who are listening to us will not like that idea, I guess, because it's like they don't want to be reduced and they really believe in the cause. And I wrote a book about it. I really believe that this sentence that is, it's easier to imagine the end of the world than to imagine the end of society, of the humanity, of the earth, or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's like crazy because it's very true. It's because we've seen it in movies somehow.
Yeah.
Which we didn't see the end of capitalism anywhere.
Yeah.
And actually, we don't even know if capitalism need to end, because the only other option we've seen so far is communism, which is also very bad for, in many, many different aspects, but also
for environmental issues. So that's also probably why we can't see the another way, or when people are saying degrowth, for example, and you're like, it's interesting, but at the same time, like, I like to think of myself being degrowth, but actually when I look at my fear, when I look at my system, I'm not so much into degrowth, some people are, obviously some people are, but most people, it's very hard. It's a very hard story to tell or to sell somehow.
Yeah, there's so much packed in there. It sounds like I would like to read your book.
It's in French.
My French is not very strong, so it'll take me a long time, but maybe we have time. Maybe there's time before the world ends. I like that idea. I like the idea of reclaiming radicality and aligning radicality with moderation, not moderation in the sense of approving of moderate policies that maintain the status quo, but moderation in terms of how you interact with yourself and how you're honest with yourself about what your real desires are and empathetic with others about what their desires are, so that you can go, wow, we really do have a radical goal and I'm not there and you're not there even in your heart yet or in my heart, but we're going to get there together. I'm going to be patient with you, and I'm going to pay just as much attention to our gains as a collaboration or as a society as to our gaps, because we don't. We're so addicted to critique. Critical theory won the Western intellect. It effaced the whole philosophical tradition before it and replaced that with itself, with a culture of critique, 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 rather than the more classical philosophical enterprise of going like, okay, we have a society and a lot of things about it work. Why does it work? What do we want to preserve? And what do we want to improve upon? You could look at the whole history of humanity in terms of where we're at right now, and we have some world conflicts going on right now that are very discouraging, but maybe we'll get beyond them. And if we do, we'll be able to look at society as a whole and go, okay, there's more human beings than ever before, and fewer of them are starving than ever before, even proportionally speaking. Even if you do the proportions between now and when there were fewer human beings, we live in general in less poverty. We have enough food to feed all of us, and we don't manage to feed all of us, but we are closer to that goal than ever before. We are arguably, if we can get past the current wars going on and other issues that we have, trending toward greater amount of human connectedness and adequate satisfaction of human basic needs. That's rad. That's amazing. That's sick. That's so cool. Unfortunately, we've done so in such a way that we've exterminated many non-human species and
60%, I think.
Ravaged non-human ecosystems. These are irreversible misfortunes. But the first thing is good, and it's a place to start from. It is, in fact, the precondition. That amount of being met in your basic needs is the precondition for even recognizing and caring about the problem. Because when your basic needs aren't met, you don't care about any other humans, let alone non-human species. So I'm not saying we have to go in this order where we can't address these things together. I'm just saying it's tiring to constantly hear critique. It's fun to constantly make critique, because as we were saying, it makes it so you never have to do the work.
But to come back on poverty, I had a chance to interview the Nobel Prize winner, French woman called Esther Duflo, who won the Nobel Prize in economy 2 years ago. And what she was explaining to me, because she got the Nobel Prize on poverty, and poverty, you're totally right. Poverty, extreme poverty worldwide has decreased. Mm-hmm. It's not amazing, but it has decreased. What you're describing is totally right. But in the meantime, what is happening is like the super, super rich got super, super richer. Mm-hmm. And there's a collapse. And people don't talk so much about it, I feel. But there's a collapse in the Western world for the middle class and lower class society. And that people are feeling, and I think this is also what is behind Trump and, you know, far-right extremism everywhere. And what she was explaining to me is that poverty, because we tend to forget that economy is a social science. It's not like hard science, not mathematic. We tend to believe that it is hard science. It is social science, just like psychology or philosophy. It's not like, and it is for her a political decision to make that so. And so there's also that issue. I mean, what you're describing is right. And yet what people are experiencing, I mean, in New York, is that they're getting poorer and poorer for most of them. And some people mm-hmm. are getting super, super rich like never before.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good point. I think that my own way of addressing that is to consider my experience rather than my monetary wealth as the touchstone for my economic well-being. Economy obviously shares a root with ecology. The ecos is the home. So the economy is the rules of the home, the house rules, as it were. And ecology is the study of it or the logic of it, its internal workings. I almost think of it as economy as the social aspect and ecology as the physical and metaphysical aspect of the same question. Because we have a finite amount of matter integrated in a bunch of material interrelations, and that's the ecological side of things. And then we have an experience thereof, and that's the economic side of things. So if I consider things from the perspective of my experience, and my experience is not everybody's, I am really poor. I have no financial security. I have no monetary wealth whatsoever. Maybe I'll inherit a little bit from my parents because they were middle class, but I won't inherit a lot. Unless I'm really clever with it, it won't grow. But I live a life where I make art about ideas that I care about, spend time with people I love, participate in important aspects of the material life process by working in community gardens and composting and things like that. That is a little nugget of wealth that can be grown from. And as we in the middle class and the lower classes are divested of monetary wealth, there is an opportunity to realize the radically made up and constructed nature of our monetary system and reorient our consciousness on experiential wealth and material wealth in the sense of access to the cultivation of the life process.
Actually, it's very interesting because I'm fighting against this idea that success is accumulation of wealth, of fame, of being famous, of fame, of followers on Instagram, mm-hmm. or on belongings. And actually, it's very interesting that I've read a study lately that was showing that only 17% of people were claiming relationship as a source of success. When actually, when you're at the end of your life, obviously, what you will consider is the quality of the relationship you had, exactly mm-hmm. what you described. And so what you're describing is a shift in what success is somehow. That's how I feel.
Yeah, yeah. I think we define success in terms of surplus. We tend to define it in terms of surplus, both financially and relationally. Social media invites you to consider other human beings in a quantitative way. Mm-hmm. I definitely do this too. I go, how many people saw this message? How many people heard it? How many people are following
we're all there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're all there. And that's the same as trying to stack banknotes. But what I actually have is more people already responding to things I make than I can keep track of. And that's true of somebody, even if they have 1,000 followers. Because if 1,000 people were responding to the thing that you posted, that would be all day, every day that you'd be operating with that.
100%.
You don't need surplus in every area. You need perhaps a minimum of surplus, even though it's sort of an oxymoronic sounding term. You mean a minimum of surplus in the sense that if your immediate stores of provisions are eliminated by disaster, you'll have some backups. And if your immediate friends die, you'll have some other followers you can you can roll into the chamber. But I think that distinction is important. And that's yet another area where I don't myself yet have full emotional digestion of that idea. But it's getting there. We all know what it feels like for an idea to travel from the head down into the heart, I think.
I don't think everyone has this understanding, actually. I feel like since we are in a world where, and I see that in the self-development world, like a lot of people read all those books and they go to those retreats and they do plant medicine and whatever. And yet they understand everything, which is, so they're aware, but it's not in the heart at all. Like, because first, like, even the four Toltec things, you cannot, I mean, just try to get one very deeply is very hard. So four. And when you read all those books, it's again accumulation of knowledge, but it's not so much. And they don't even, I mean, a lot of people that I've seen, they don't even realize that it's not in their heart. It's they can talk about it very easily, but yet they are not aware that they haven't integrated, basically.
Yeah, I agree, and I have been there. I played a show not long ago, and it was a long set, and I was talking a lot. As you can tell, I like to run my mouth, hear myself talk. And I was holding forth on this and that topic, and my songs are very philosophical, and I had a song about mental well-being, and I had a song about stoicism, and I was just really going off. And at some points I was talking about God and the concept of God and what God means for the universe philosophically, cosmologically, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I went on and on and on. I thought it was a good set. And this woman came up to me afterward, and she was like, "You are very smart and you talk very well about God, but you need to find him." And I was like, wow, she saw. And I was like, that's a powerful piece of observation, because I had just had a very traumatic summer where I sort of fell apart mentally. Me, the guy who makes content about stoicism and about God. And I was like, wow. So that's what began a process of trying to open the valves of self enough to feel the trickle of the idea down from the cerebral into the heart. And even that I don't want to talk about too much, because then it makes it just a reified concept. But it can happen. And it can happen even if people don't have the words for that process or don't put it in such intellectualized form, you know?
And earlier, I was talking to you about this high confidence gray zone. And, I think, I mean, it works for ecology. It works, I mean, as we speak, we are in the middle, and I hope it won't be the case when I will release the episode, but we are in the middle of this Israeli crisis. Also, many other wars that are going on, and we don't talk so much about it anymore. What do you think about people being sure that they need to have a point of view, and also that their point of view is the right one, and fighting between blue and red, whether they are like blue or red. I'm not talking about Democrat and Republican, but, you know, a different type of ideas, binary ideas.
Yeah. I think that, returning to some of the themes we talked about, the real radical invitation now is to acknowledge that you have more than one view, even in yourself. And so you're bound to find contradictory views represented in others. And that the work is to see both sides of the debate and not to stand in the middle like a person separating two things and trying to keep them from combining, but helping to negotiate and moderate their synthesis into one thing. Synthesis is much different than centrism. And I like this high gray, high confidence gray concept for that reason, because all you can be confident in is synthesis. I think, insofar as Hegel has anything meaningful to say, the world is interplay of different forces that in their collision combine and don't just repel. And so that's how ideas progress. Even consensus, when it operates in a small group anarchistic space, undergoes precisely that process where different voices combine and synthesize and become a new position agreed upon by everybody. And that's a compromise of a kind, but it's a compromise only in the same way that having a child is a compromise, because it's a blend of two genetic profiles. And I think we can think of our ideas that way.
But what do you would you answer to people telling you, or that's what they told me, actually, that it's very easy not to take a position and not to have an opinion? It means that, you know, there is this quote that is, not taking position is taking the position of the oppressor, whoever the the oppressor is.
Well, I don't think you're talking about not taking a position. You're talking about being able to occupy more than one position at once.
Yeah.
Quantum phenomena do it. Why not us? We're ultimately built of quantum phenomena. So let's have superposition. Let's have more than one position at once. I hold the position that Israel is a state that I have love for because I've spent time there and people I care about there, and it's good there for somebody like me who wants to freely cultivate ideas and express himself and live my life as I live it. And I think that's valid. And I think it is built on utter violence and destruction and devastation and at times genocidal activities. And I think that those activities are in response to aggression they received. And I think Palestine has a right to exist. And I think that there's no solution that yet adequately meets their need to actualize that right. I think all of those things. That is not a solution. I'm not in charge. But that's honest. I think all of those things.
No, but I do think the same. And actually, if it was as simple as an Instagram post, I guess the issue would be solved. I don't really think what people, I totally acknowledge that people need to complain on the on both sides, actually. Mm-hmm. The horror of what Hamas did, and it was like horror. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't really have another word for that. And yet, I totally understand also the pro-Palestine saying, well, they are performing something horrible there, and they are not respecting the rights since 1948, which is also true. And actually,
it's also true that they have been, at least in America, vastly underrepresented in the discourse of the left.
Yeah,
it's been typically a very rarefied position to give a shit about Palestine until recently, and so that awakening is extremely important.
And actually, you did a video about that, and I would like to, I'm sure you cannot perform again the same video, but you were explaining how this war is actually, it might actually be good for Palestine because of the global awakening on the situation.
Yeah, this has been a controversial little thread of my own thought, because it brings to my mind the psychological and social experience of the era of Black Lives Matter in the summer of George Floyd's killing here in the United States. Because in that case, you had, you know, a fair amount of people on the left, mostly on the farther edge of the left, who would go to anti-police violence protests and were familiar with Black Lives Matter as a concept and were protesting police's mistreatment and murder of black people. That was happening, but not at that scale. Suddenly there was a sea change moment where one thing sufficiently made it mimetically into the mainstream of discourse on social media that turned everybody suddenly into a radical. And I myself and other people were chanting Black Lives Matter and chanting defund the police or abolish the police, without having any conception of what that would entail or really evaluating how that would look or whether they actually wanted it, middle-class suburban white people who are living in Brooklyn. Do you really want that? Do you even have any concept of that? I can understand that intellectually you've now broached the possibility, but as we were talking about earlier, that has not made it down into the ventricles of the heart. It has not fully entered the bloodstream. It's not exceeded the blood-brain barrier. And it's a similar thing with Free Palestine right now, or sometimes sentiments that seem like they are tantamount to abolishing Israel or to rejecting the legitimacy of Israel as a state. All good things to be talking about, really good, tough and terrible things to be talking about. But the unfortunate corollary of that analogy is that in both cases, it required death, murder, to get it into our conversation. Not murder that was of the same kind or the same dynamics of oppressor versus oppressed, different situations altogether. But it's troubling to consider that so often we let violence be the ultimate catalyst for radical thinking and radical discourse, and beginning that process of applying those to policy changes and policy advocacy. And I think that is important to acknowledge as a reality, and to make that acknowledgement as a precondition for changing that reality in the future.
Actually, I was, I told you this sentence that I've heard last week from Jewish people, actually, which was, if you want a peace, be prepared for war.
Mm.
And I thought it was very profound, because at first you're like, what? And then you get a thinking about it and you're like, yeah, maybe that's right. And what you're describing is actually exactly that somehow.
Yeah. And then we can use it as an opportunity to refine what we actually think about conflict and war. I don't know. I don't know what my war philosophy is. I'm familiar with just war theory. We're talking about Christianity, which is the literal content of the gospel seems like it points toward nonviolence, but classically philosophers like Augustine and Aquinas have put forward just war theory as this notion that there are situations in which the needs of justice make it so the taking of human life is valid and sanctioned by even the logic of the gospel itself. So that's a contradiction that they offer and has traditionally been offered. I don't know if I think that. I think my own beginning with that dialectic of contradiction would be to make a distinction between immediate physical encounter with another human being and advocacy for or participation in nation-level conflict between groups of human beings. If somebody burst in the door right now, this would be a really exciting podcast, and they were trying to, you know, choke you to death, and I, in order to neutralize them, had to fight them within an inch of their life. I was taking jujitsu for a while.
Okay. I'm safe for now.
but I dropped out. you wouldn't be safe. That's one proposition, which is a different proposition than, do I think that there are ever situations where humans should organize to kill other humans in an organized and premeditated fashion? I don't have an answer for that, but I don't know. That's what thinking through it looks like for me anyway.
And to come back to ecology, because you were talking about death and how somehow death, not maybe war, make us acknowledge things. And I thought about COVID, because COVID was a very high ecological moment somehow, real, because of the death. And well, it didn't work eventually, but not much. Or maybe a little, there were a little grain that stayed with us, I hope. But then I thought about ecosophy, and I know that ecosophy is a word dear to you. And do you think that within ecosophy, so the wisdom of the household somehow, ingrained that death is needed, if you follow where I'm going, where I'm coming from, and where I'm going.
But the question then
the question is, maybe in ecosophy, you also need the death so that we really take actions and make people move.
That is an interesting proposition. There's a book by a writer named Andreas Malm called How to Blow Up a Pipeline. Are you familiar with this book?
I haven't read it.
It got made into a movie. The movie is apparently a fiction movie. The book is nonfiction. I don't know if I can recommend the movie. I've never seen it.
But neither did I.
It's a book about blowing up pipelines, but it's nonfiction, and then they made a fiction movie, which seems like pretty much the way things go. But in the book, it's making a case for certain forms of violence within the climate movement. Malm observes that he's been involved in climate protests from the beginning of the movement to the present day. He's worked with Extinction Rebellion, whatever, different organizations the world over. And he talks about how if you were to chart the amount of awareness of